From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
My own historic alarm clock, which has rung several times in the past in the presence of some of you, tells me that the women's liberation movement has crested now. We can't go any longer with conscious raising, with talk. If it doesn't become political, it will peter out. It will turn against itself and become nothing.
Feminist pioneer Betty Friedan has died. She was the founder of the National Organization for Women and author of many books, including the groundbreaking The Feminine Mystique. She helped launch the feminist movement. We'll hear Friedan speaking in 1971 and talk with her biographer, as well as a leading TV anchor, about her effect on women in this country. But first, we remember actor, radio host, and political activist Grandpa Al Lewis. He died this weekend. We'll hear him in his own words.
Were the lives on September 11th more valuable than over 100,000 people who were killed in Guatemala? Are they sub-lives? What are they? In Nicaragua, you want me to go down the list? In Chile? Was that horrific? Was that terror?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Muslims are continuing to protest around the world over the publication of cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad wearing a turban shaped as a bomb with a burning fuse. The cartoons first appeared in a Danish newspaper in September. Muslims say the images are blasphemous and contrary to Islamic tradition prohibiting depictions of the Prophet. In Lebanon and Syria, protesters set ablaze the Danish embassy. Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and Libya have all recalled ambassadors from Denmark. In Jordan, two newspaper editors have been arrested for reprinting the cartoons. In Afghanistan, one person died after police opened fire on protesters. In Iraq, over 1,000 Sunni Muslims protested in Ramadi, calling for Iraq to end political, diplomatic, cultural, and economic relations with any European country where the cartoons were reprinted. Protests were also held in Indonesia, Thailand, the West Bank, and New Zealand. Earlier today, Denmark issued a list of 14 Muslim countries which Danish travelers should avoid. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has reiterated the U.S. will consider attacking Iran to stop its nuclear program. In an interview with a German newspaper, Rumsfeld said, quote, all options, including the military one, are on the table. Over the weekend, the conflict between the Western powers and Iran intensified as Iran pledged to stop voluntarily complying with orders of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran said it will no longer allow surprise inspections and it will resume its uranium enrichment. However, Iran also said it's willing to consider moving its uranium enrichment activities onto Russian soil in an effort to end international suspicions over its nuclear activity. Iran maintains it is operating a nuclear program for purely peaceful means, but the U.S. and other nations claim Iran is secretly building a nuclear weapons program. The pioneering feminist and writer Betty Friedan has died at the age of 85. Her 1963 manifesto, The Feminine Mystique, was credited with launching the modern women's movement. Friedan helped form the National Organization for Women and served as NOW's first president. At the time, she staked out positions that seemed extreme on such issues as abortion, sex-neutral help-wanted ads, equal pay, promotion opportunities, and maternity leave. Betty Friedan also helped found NARAL, which was originally known as the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws. In 1971, she helped launch the National Women's Political Caucus. This is Betty Friedan speaking at the event.
Up until now, the politics of our two-party system, the politics of bosses and machines, has been based on manipulation of minorities by the white minority, the white male minority in power. What unites women as a majority, as evidenced here today, is the refusal to be manipulated any longer.
That was Betty Friedan. She died Saturday on her 85th birthday. On Capitol Hill, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is testifying today before the Senate over the Bush administration's domestic spying program. While Gonzalez is expected to claim the Bush administration can legally carry out the warrantless spying, Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Arlen Specter has admitted the administration's legal reasoning does not hold up. He appeared on Tim Russert's program Meet the Press on Sunday.
The administration says that they didn't need to, that they already had authority from Congress when back in October 2002, Congress voted an authorization to go to war against Iraq, and this is part of that war.
I believe that contention is very strained and unrealistic. The authorization for the use of force doesn't say anything about electronic surveillance. The issue was never raised with the Congress. And there is a specific statute on the books, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which says flatly that you can't undertake that kind of surveillance without a court order.
Meanwhile, a new article in the Washington Post raises questions over the effectiveness of the domestic spy program. Intelligence officers who took part in the eavesdropping on thousands of Americans say they dismissed nearly all of them as potential suspects after hearing nothing pertinent to a terrorist threat. According to the Washington Post, fewer than 10 U.S. citizens or residents a year have aroused enough suspicion during warrantless eavesdropping to justify interception of their domestic calls. A major spy scandal has also erupted in Greece, where it's been uncovered that the mobile phones of the country's entire political and military elite were tapped ahead of the Olympic Games in Athens 2 years ago. Among those targeted were the foreign, defense, and public order ministers, as well as the prime minister and the leadership of the armed forces. Others included civil rights activists, the head of the Stop the War Coalition, journalists, and Arabs based in Athens. The Greek government says it's unclear who carried out the eavesdropping. According to the Observer of London, high-tech software was put in place at the telephone company Vodafone that enabled phone conversations to be diverted to a set of 14 shadow mobile phones, which then relayed them to a recording system. Officials say the calls were intercepted on mobile phones picked up by antenna in an area close to the U.S. Embassy. The Greek government has launched a judicial investigation but has denied U.S. agents were behind the plot. Vodafone reported the eavesdropping to the Greek government last March, but before doing so, the company had shut down the system, making it impossible for investigators to determine who was carrying out the spying. A federal judge has scheduled the trial of Vice President Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, to begin in January of next year, just after the November midterm elections. He faces 5 counts of perjury, making false statements and obstruction of justice in the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Meanwhile, another of the new developments in the case has come to light because of recent court filings. According to the Washington Post, court records show that Libby denied to a grand jury he ever mentioned Plame or her CIA job to then White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer or then New York Times reporter Judith Miller. The records also suggest that Libby did not disclose to investigators that he first spoke to Miller about Plame in June 2003, and that prosecutors learned of the nature of the conversation only when Miller finally testified late in the fall of 2005. In other news from Washington, the Capitol Police, Secret Service, and FBI have launched an investigation into why a U.S. citizen of Indian descent was detained for over an hour after he attended the State of the Union as a guest of a member of Congress. Police said the man resembled someone on Secret Service photo watch list, but after President Bush's address ended, 10 law enforcement officers surrounded the man as he exited the chamber of the House. They whisked him away to a room where they questioned him for close to an hour. After the incident, the man told his Congress member, Alcee Hastings, that the experience was, quote, maybe just the price of being brown in America. At the same event, anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan was arrested and removed for wearing a T-shirt that read 2,242 dead, how many more, in reference to U.S. troops killed in Iraq. The charges were later dropped. In California, a maximum security prison outside of Los Angeles remains in lockdown after a prisoner died on Saturday during a prison-wide fight. Officials say more than 100 prisoners were injured. At least 20 prisoners were hospitalized. The Los Angeles Times reported a long line of ambulances and paramedic units lined up outside the jail, and rows of tarps were laid out for the injured. The American Civil Liberties Union of Southern California has long warned about the conditions of the jail. The ACLU's Jody Kent said, quote, there isn't enough opportunity for the inmates to do productive things, and that allows for the tensions to rise. As a result of that, fights will often break out, she said. Sheriff Lee Baca blamed the violence in part on overcrowding and understaffing due to budget cuts. He said in some instances, prisoners outnumber deputies 100-1. In an ideal situation, the sheriff said, the ratio would be 6-1. On a typical Saturday night, 77 deputies are on duty to watch 4,000 prisoners. Baca said, quote, the more you crowd a facility, the more difficult it is to prevent violence. The fighting reportedly broke out between African-American and Latino prisoners. In Egypt, officials are estimating 1,000 people are dead or missing from last week's ferry accident. Survivors and relatives are blaming the ferry operator for ignoring a fire that eventually brought down the ship. Questions are also being raised about why it took the Egyptian government 7 hours to begin search and rescue operations. So far, over 400 people have been rescued, but doctors do not expect many more survivors. Here in New York, actor and activist Al Lewis has died. He died at the age of 82. In the acting world, he was best known for playing Grandpa on The Munsters. He was also a lifelong activist. He ran for New York governor on the Green Party ticket and was a longtime radio host on Pacifica radio station WBAI. We'll have more on Grandpa Al Lewis in just a few minutes. In Georgia, over 40,000 mourners paid their respects to civil rights pioneer Coretta Scott King by filing past her open casket in the state capitol's rotunda. She became the first woman and the first African-American person to lie in honor there. She died last Monday at the age of 78. Today's Coretta Scott King's body will lie in honor at the original Ebenezer Baptist Church, where her late husband, Dr. Martin Luther King, once preached. And also today marks the 30th anniversary of the imprisonment of Native American activist Leonard Peltier. Rallies are being held across the country to call for his release. Leonard Peltier was convicted of killing two FBI agents during a shootout on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in 1975. Peltier has long maintained his innocence. This is from an interview in 2000 I did with him from jail.
My name is Leonard Peltier. I'm a Lakota and Chippewa Native American from the state of North Dakota. I am currently serving two life sentences for the deaths of two FBI agents in Leavenworth, United States Penitentiary.
Did you kill the FBI agents?
No, I did not.
Leonard Peltier. We'll post an MP3 of the full interview on our website at democracynow.org. In a recent statement to supporters, Peltier said, quote, we're all geared up to file more appeals on new information my legal team has found while reviewing withheld documents. I want you to know that we will continue to fight for my freedom, Peltier wrote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For the first part of today's broadcast, we're going to remember the actor, radio host, and political activist, Grandpa Al Lewis. He died on Friday after several years of failing health. There are conflicting reports over his age at the time of his death. He was thought to be 95 years old, but according to his son, well, in fact, he was 82. Al Lewis was best known for his roles on two 1960s comedy series, Grandpa on The Munsters and Officer Leo Schauser on the 1950s comedy Car 54, Where Are You? He was also a lifelong political activist and an outspoken critic of U.S. policy at home and abroad. In 1998, he ran for governor of New York as the Green Party candidate against Governor George Pataki. He also took turns as a basketball scout, a restaurant owner in Greenwich Village, the restaurant Grandpa's, and a radio host on WBAI in New York. Grandpa Al's death was announced on Saturday by WBAI program director Bernard White during the same time slot that Grandpa used to host his weekly program. I'll play an excerpt of that interview that Bernard White and I conducted with Grandpa Al Lewis on April 10th, 1997. We pick up the interview where Grandpa Al Lewis talked about his early involvement in political activities. Here he talks about the case of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, the married couple convicted and executed for conspiring to spy for the Soviet Union at the height of the McCarthy era in the 1950s.
Most people don't remember. When the Rosenbergs were executed, their funeral was in Brooklyn, although they didn't live in Brooklyn, at I.J. Morris. And most people are not aware the two bodies were on view. And a group of us were there to make sure that no maniac came in and threw acid, and it was all kinds of crazies around, you know, during the height of the McCarthy period. It was just, and the line started to form at 6 in the morning. The viewing didn't open till about 10, and it was a group of us from the NMU in there. And most people are not aware that the majority of people who came to view the Rosenbergs as they laid in their coffins were black people. I was there from the get-go before they opened the mortuary. Had a couple of incidents, one with Daily News report, I still remember her name. Ruth Montgomery was trying to sneak a camera in. We did not allow pictures to be taken, you know, this and that. You know, I grabbed the bag and the camera, and, you know, she said, "You can't do that." And I said, "I know you ain't going to stop me. I know that. And you can attempt to call the police. You want to do that? There's about 8,000 people waiting in line. You want to start a riot? Now get out of here. Take your camera and get out." Anyway, he had made a decision. The good doctor had made a decision to go to the cemetery. And you can read the front page of the New York Times. At least 1,000 cars who followed the hearse, children, grandmother. And I had to make sure that nobody messed with William Edward Burkhart Du Bois. So, as we say in them old westerns, you know, we're going to round up a posse. Somebody's got to ride shotgun. Well, Al Lewis rode shotgun. And I always said, man, any mother's son put his foot on that running board. In those years there was running board. I want to know if he could swallow a 45 to go right in his mouth. That's it.
So there was
That's
no
what we
trouble.
Call even Steven. You no. make your play, I'll make mine. Take it from there.
Well, why do you figure, did you ever think about this, why so many black folks went to visit the, see the, view the bodies of the Rosenbergs?
They were not black radicals. Most of them were women. And I think they understood, I don't even know if they felt that they were innocent or guilty, or I think they just felt that they shouldn't have been executed. It's like down in the South, Mississippi, when they used to march them from the penitentiary at Parchman Farm. Mm-hmm. The women working in the cotton fields didn't know these men. And they used to sing, and the song came out of that. Another man done gone. Another man done gone to the parchment farm. And it was that kind of an affinity that they had with people who, you have to understand, see, people don't understand whether they did or didn't. Certainly the trial didn't prove that. That they were communist sympathizers, whatever you want to call it. You have to understand the period, that, things grow out of soil. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to grow broccoli out of a rock. You need the proper soil. And in those communities, because that was my community, Brownsville, East New York, you know how people knew what communists were? Didn't read a book, didn't read a pamphlet. During the Depression, the marshal came and evicted 20 people a day. And here come the communists, then the YCLers, Young Communist League, who's the marshal leave, go up, break the lock, carry the furniture back in. Now, who do you think them people are going to... Mm-hmm. That's what they knew, communists. I mean, read John L. Lewis's book. Toughest places to organize was in the South. Harlan County, good Lord. I mean, you get off the train, they shoot you. Bus, don't matter. And he used to bring in communists. And that's what people knew them as. They didn't know nothing about no ideology, the Soviet Union, Karl Marx. They didn't know what the heck that was. And so it was that kind of an affinity. These people are putting their lives out on the line and getting hit on their... Good, if I don't remember, 1,000 battles. They used to call it home relief. Now they call it welfare in the 30s. And battles, they wouldn't give their lady a home relief, or they cut her off, or they took away this and stuff. And then the battles with the police. Well, I mean, people say, geez, these are... Wow. So if they were communists, they were probably moving back furniture the same way. It's that kind of an affinity that underdogs have.
We're talking to Al Lewis, longtime actor and political activist. And Al, we just couldn't resist. Remember Vera Hall?
Another man done gone. Another man done gone from the county farm. Another man done gone. I didn't know his name. 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 He had a long chain on. 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 He killed another man. He killed another man. He killed another man. He killed another man. I don't know where he's gone.
I don't
know where he's gone. I don't know where he's gone. I don't know where he's gone. I'm gonna walk your love. I'm gonna walk your log. I'm gonna walk your log. I'm gonna.
So, what is it in your past that made you pick the side that you on? I mean, there were many people, excuse me, that you worked with.
I think somebody hexed me at birth.
Because you could have just made money and been very comfortable and not have anything to do with.
That's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
That's the way it's supposed to be. You fight for what you believe in. As I said many a time, I'm my mother's son. I remember my mother taking me to demonstrations. I was a boy. My mother was a, I guess, what was that? The bell curve would say she was an ignorant peasant woman from Europe. Came here, girl of 15, worked in the sweatshops, brought over 5 daughters and her mother and father from Europe. Worked on her back. Worked all her life, sweatshops. Garment center.
Polish?
Never had
Polish?
A vacation, my mother. Never went to a movie. Didn't have the time. Bringing up a family, taking care of her 5 sisters, and her mother and father brought them here from Europe. Had to earn money for passage and everything. And my mother was the kind of woman who understood the class struggle. Well, my mother worked as a forelady in the garment center, and the boss said, you know, it's kind of hot. Let's open the window. My mother thinking was, if the boss says open the window, no, we keep it closed. That's it. That's it. And my mother used to go on demonstrations. Or my mother used to. See, you people don't remember. You're all youngsters. But during the Depression, people selling on the street corner. And along came the police officer of that day and used to attempt, not all, but many, to get a dollar or two bribe. Otherwise, you can't stay here. And my mother was the kind of woman who would say, in broken English, I'll do my mother now. Hey, why are you doing that? Why are you bothering that man? He's trying to make a living. Get away from there, to the policeman. And I was a little kid, I was embarrassed. I think I'm going to get hit on, pull my mother. Don't pull me. Why are you doing that? Well, my mother had a voice bigger than mine. And suddenly there's 50 people there, and the cop is getting scared. You know, for a dollar, he's trying to get from the guy selling garbanzo beans, Arbus, we called them, or sweet potatoes or something. And here's a mob, and he don't know if they're going to tear his head off. And he walked away. But that's that was in, I'm my mother's son. That's it. I mean, I don't know how else to explain it. And then, of course...
Oh, that explains it very well.
I armed myself with facts and figures, and you know what I mean? And, you know, but that's how my mother was. My mother, you know, little lady and fearless.
Grandpa Al Lewis on Democracy Now, April 10th, 1997. He died this past Friday in Roosevelt Island at his home. We'll come back to the interview that Bernard White and I did with him in a minute. The theme of the Munsters. Grandpa Al Lewis was one of its stars. He died this past Friday in Roosevelt Island. We're going to go back to the interview that I did with him, with my colleague at WBAI, Bernard White, on Democracy Now! It was April 10th, 1997.
I wanted to go back to W.E.B. Du Bois for a minute, as you, a few years later, a few decades later, when you met him, mm-hmm. From the story you're telling about your mother. What was he like, and how did you find his concerns and what he talked about similar to what your mother mm-hmm. cared about?
My meetings with a good doctor were not social meetings. I think I was once in his house at Grace Court when he lived, that beautiful house.
In New York City.
By the river, near Hicks, Pine, Orange, Pineapple, you know, in that area. I think I may have been there once, and that was some kind of a pot, I don't remember. Arthur Miller had a house there, Norman Rosten had a house there. I don't know, some kind of a party or something. My conversations were never of lengthy conversations. I would meet him at certain situations where he needed protection, you know, all kinds of crazies in this world, you know what I mean? And I was there to trump an ace, you know what I mean? And so we talked 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes, and, you know. And as again, I would say, the good doctor, as far as I can remember, never participated like tonight is a demonstration, you know, in the killing, you know, of this young man, Cedeno. Not a good doctor wouldn't be in the crowd. He would address the crowd if they, you understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And so if he had to go there to address the crowd, me and a guy named Popeye, me and them, you and the other guy would make sure that there ain't no crazies around, you know, and if they are, you pay the price, that's it.
So he didn't join demonstrations?
I'm sorry?
He didn't join demonstrations.
Well, I don't know what you mean by joining them.
He didn't march.
He marched with a picket sign?
Yeah.
I never knew of him to do that. I knew him even before he married Shirley, you know, Shirley Graham. In his later years, he married Shirley. And then they both went to Tanzania, you know, because of the, trial, and, you know, arrested, and handcuffed, and embarrassing. You know.
Why was he arrested?
So-called Smith Act communists, you know. Why was Paul Robeson? He took his passport away. I mean, you know, it's like Lord Acton said, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
You knew Paul Robeson?
Oh, very well. Very well. Very well. Doing very well. Oh, yeah.
How'd you get to know?
First as a football player. Yes, sirree. All-American. And it's a damn shame. You're not supposed to say goddamn. Can't say that. There's a lot of these Christian people listening going to jump up in the air. But it's a damn shame that he's not in the Football Hall of Fame. That's right. He was a great, great football player. Besides, most people don't know he was an LLD. He was a lawyer. Mm-hmm. Has a law degree. Didn't practice, but he had a law degree. Yeah. Brilliant man. Brilliant linguist. Great singer. Great actor.
Yeah. So how do you used to hang around with him also?
Yeah. With the boys. Boys in the hood.
Remember this one?
I think I hear you clapping.
Yeah, that's me. I can pick up 1965,
Paul Robeson.
When Israel was in Egypt's land, let my people go. Oppressed so hard they could not stand, let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down.
I'm really glad that you went into acting.
You what?
I'm glad that you went into acting.
Oh, really?
Because singing is not your thing.
No, but you don't understand. You see, you don't understand. I've been in musicals on Broadway, and they asked me, do you sing? I sing, yes, I sing poorly but passionately.
That you do.
Yes, I do.
What did you sing on Broadway?
Last thing I did on Broadway was Do Re Mi, musical, Comden and Green, Jules Stein, Phil Silvers, Nancy Walker.
What'd you sing?
1960. We opened Christmas week. David Merrick was the producer. Garson Kanin was the director.
But what did you sing?
What did I sing?
Yes.
What did I sing? Oh, I sang. I didn't have a solo, obviously. It was white backlash. I sing. Great. There was one great song in there that Julie wrote. May you rest in peace. Make someone happy. Make just one someone happy. And you will be happy too. I sing better than you, Bernard. You know that?
Oh, come on.
No.
We're going to have a contest.
Heard, you know me?
You have.
Oh, yeah.
And you still say that and you've heard me?
Yeah. You know why? Because you don't sing with feeling. You know, funny thing. I was years ago, Wilson, the black band leader, he had a jazz show in L.A., and KGOL, I think it was, and he was interviewing the conductor, Zubin Mehta, you know, famous world famous woman. And Zubin said a very, very interesting thing. They were talking about they had played a record or something, a gospel song, and he said, for me, it's not judging whether the singers are great or spectacular or just okay, but when I hear them sing, I believe them. Mm-hmm. You hear that?
Mm-hmm.
See, now when I sing, they believe me.
We're talking to Al Lewis. In a few weeks, he's going to be celebrating his birthday on April 30th. He's going to be 88, and what a life he's led through this 20th century. When he finished up the Broadway run of Do Re Mi with Phil Silvers and Nancy Walker, he was summoned along with Fred Gwynne to test for the Munsters, and we're going to talk about that with him when we come back. Stay with us. And that was Grandpa Al Lewis, interviewed April 10th, 1997.
His age, well, there are different stories about his age. While he was alive, we thought he now was 95, but it turns out, according to his son, in fact, he died at the age of 82. He died on Friday at Roosevelt Island, where he lived. Our condolences to the Lewis family. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. If you'd like to hear the full hour interview that Bernard White and I did with Grandpa Al Lewis on April 10th, 1997, on Democracy Now! At the first few years of the program, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. We're going to go to break, and when we come back, we're going to look at the legacy of feminist pioneer Betty Friedan. She also died this weekend. She died on Saturday on her 85th birthday. Betty Friedan was one of the founders of the National Organization for Women Now, which today has grown into the largest women's rights group in the United States. In 1966, Friedan was NOW's first president, a post she held for 4 years. She was also author of the groundbreaking book, The Feminine Mystique. The book is widely credited for helping to launch the feminist movement and is viewed as one of the most important books of the 20th century. We'll go to break and then come back.
Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be now. No. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Whoa, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby are alive. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be. What about this overcrowded land? How much more we use from man? Can't you stand that?
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we remember the life of Betty Friedan, who died this weekend at the age of 85, Kim Gandhi, NOW's current president, said, quote, "The feminine mystique opened women's eyes. Betty recognized a longing in the women of her generation, a longing for something more. Opportunity, recognition, fulfillment, success, a chance to live their own dreams beyond the narrow definition of womanhood that had limited their lives." In 1971, Betty Friedan co-founded the National Women's Political Caucus. This is an excerpt of her speech at the group's founding meeting.
My own historic alarm clock, which has rung several times in the past in the presence of some of you, tells me that the women's liberation movement has crested now. We can't go any longer with conscious raising, with talk. If it doesn't become political, it will peter out. It will turn against itself and become nothing. Up until now, the politics of our two-party system, the politics of bosses and machines, has been based on manipulation of minorities by the white minority, the white male minority in power. What unites women as a majority, as evidenced here today, is the refusal to be manipulated any longer.
Betty Friedan at the founding meeting of the National Women's Political Caucus in 1971. An excerpt from the 1971 television documentary, The Hand That Rocks the Ballot Box. Our first guest produced and hosted that documentary, Marlene Sanders. For over 30 years, she was a correspondent, writer, executive with ABC and CBS News. In 1964, she became the first woman to anchor the evening news, and 12 years later, the first to become a network news executive. She's currently an adjunct professor at New York University's Department of Journalism, where she teaches television reporting, and she's co-author of the book Waiting for Primetime, The Women of Television News. We're also joined by Barbara Seaman, longtime women's health activist, author of many books, including The Doctor's Case Against the Pill, one of the first indictments of the birth control pill. She published that book in 1969. Her latest book is The Greatest Experiment Ever Performed on Women, Exploding the Estrogen Myth. She's also co-founder of the National Women's Health Network. And we're joined by Judith Hennessy. She's the author of the definitive biography, Betty Friedan, Her Life. And we welcome you all to Democracy Now!
Good to be here,
Amy. It's great to have you with us. I wanted to start with Judith Hennessy. You wrote the biography of Betty Friedan.
Yes.
She was exploded onto the scene with the feminine mystique. Can you talk about how that book came into being?
It started with a questionnaire that she sent to her Smith College colleagues, more or less, graduates, some years after they had all graduated, and she and some other friends sat down together to find out how all these women were living, how they felt about their lives, what they were doing with their lives. And the questionnaires came back, some of them rather heavily annotated. And Betty had a very strong sense and intuition, really, that there was something very wrong with all of this. You know, the women were not complainers, but in there, in between the lines, was this feeling that things just weren't going well at all, or things weren't really going anywhere. They weren't doing anything. Their lives were, empty, in many ways. And Betty had her own problems with her own life, which she felt pretty much the same way herself, which may be the real reason why she sent the questionnaire out. But she didn't put it that way. And she decided to interview more people, more women. And she went to Radcliffe Women and others who were in similar positions. You know, most of them were housewives. They were well off for the most part. They were comfortable. They were intelligent. For an outsider, they lived rather well, and there wasn't anything wrong, really. But she kept going, and that's how the feminine mystique got together. She interviewed and interviewed and interviewed. I mean, Betty was a very rigorous researcher. She always did things right.
And the feminine mystique, the central thesis of the book, what was the mystique?
The central thesis is that women are not equal to men, are not given a chance to be equal to men, that the entire society is built, constructed, and created by men, and women are just left out of the world. They may have a very good education, but the whole society is set up to keep them at home with the children and to keep them buying things to be good consumers. She felt that this certainly did not do justice to women and to the possibilities that was in them, the abilities that they had.
Marlene Sanders, let me bring you into the conversation. When did you first meet Betty Friedan, or maybe I should say, when did you first hear of Betty Friedan?
Well, of course, I heard of her when the book came out in 63, but we met in 65. I was working for ABC and reporting on the Great Society program of LBJ, and there was a reception for the beginning of Head Start, and I was in a receiving line at the White House and ended up standing next to Betty, whom I'd never met. So we began a conversation, and we continued it at the shuttle going back to New York, and then we continued it for about 40 years thereafter.
And you did a documentary.
I did about 7 documentaries on the women's movement, mostly including her. She was hard to edit because she never finished a sentence. Her mind was so quick, she was so brilliant, that before a sentence was finished, another one would come along, and it was very hard for radio, for TV, to get to an end of a sentence and stop her. But she always had interesting things to say. And what Judith was saying was when she did all those surveys, she named the problem as the problem that had no name because it wasn't quite, you couldn't get your hand around it. But there was this dissatisfaction with women. And I have to say that the society is so changed by her that if you went back to the 50s, it would be unrecognizable to a lot of people today.
And what was the response in the media to the feminine mystique when it came out?
Ridicule by the media. I think women responded in huge numbers to it. I mean, it touched them. They knew what she was talking about. But I can remember when I started covering the movement, when I was doing news stories about it, and since I was the only woman at ABC, sometimes they had to send a man to an event, and they would come to me and say, "Well, what is this about? Is it about who opens the door for a woman or who lights her cigarette?" Shows you how dated this is. I mean, they did not understand what it was all about. So it took a long time for the idea to get through that, yes, we wanted to be out there and get the good jobs and get paid and not be relegated to the home. But it was not well received at first by the powers that be.
Barbara Seaman.
Hi.
Hi, it's good to have you with us. You also really launched the modern-day women's health movement. Your very well-known book, The Doctor's Case Against the Pill, as well as other books that you've written. What did Betty Friedan mean to you?
Betty Friedan was my girlfriend for many years. She and I both worked for the women's magazines, Ladies Home Journal and McCall's and Good Housekeeping and so on. And we were the two most feminist voices, I on the health issues and women's rights vis-a-vis their doctors and whether they should make the decision themselves whether to have breastfeed or whether to have a C-section. And she was very much with us on those topics. So I met her through the magazine groups we belonged to. And she told me something very interesting that I would like to mention here. I didn't see it mentioned in any of the obits, but there's always been this question on why, after the first wave, feminists made so much achievement in 1920 and thereafter. What happened after World War II that made women go back into the home and be told that it was wrong for them to work, take jobs away from the men, that their fulfillment would be in being the handmaiden? And Betty told me how this came about. It's a very interesting story. Because of Rosie the Riveter and all the women who were urged to go out to work by the government during World War II, when the war ended and the boys came home and the government, the Labor Department, decided that women had to be encouraged to give up their jobs and come back to be housewives. And they actually sent around spokespeople to all the women's magazines with synopses of stories they should run and how to get women to come back into the home. So the women's magazines played a huge role, which was dictated by the government, to make women feel that they should stay home and be mothers and wives. That was it was real propaganda. And she was aware of what was going on because she started working in the women's magazines while this was happening, a few years ahead of me. And that was a secret that was never really made public, but I think that that had a big effect on making Betty want to work through the women's magazines do the opposite when somebody's been brainwashed, to de-brainwash the women.
To deprogram.
Yes, she was determined to deprogram the women who were reading the women's magazines, and she did a fabulous job. It worked.
Now, according, Judith Hennessy, to your book, Betty Friedan, Her Life, Betty Friedan actually wanted to be an actress?
Yes, but that was really a passing thing while she was growing up. I wouldn't really take that too seriously.
But could I just interject that at that time, that was one of the things that women could do. They could be teachers, nurses, or in the theater, or performance.
Secretary.
But there were very few options, so a lot of women at that time, including me later, wanted to do the same thing. It seemed just more interesting than the other options.
One of the things she told me was had a big crush on Nancy Reagan, who was a couple of years ahead of her at Smith. And when Nancy graduated from Smith and came to New York to go into on the stage, that was when Betty had her period when she said, "Oh, that's for me. I'm going to be like Nancy."
Now, one of the things Betty Friedan did was found one organization after another. National Organization for Women, National Women's Political Caucus, NARAL, which has changed its name, though not acronym, over the years, starting with National Abortion Rights...
It was to repeal abortion
to
laws.
Appeal laws
RAL
around abortion.
Yeah.
Can you talk, Judith Hennessy, about her organizing abilities?
She would have all these ideas about what to do, and this enormous energy and determination to change things, to better things. She would just jump right in and gather a group of people and just plunge in and do it. It came out of her gut, really. It's hard to describe and explain this.
But understanding that kind of the importance of that strategizing and that movement building, it seems, is what Betty Friedan brought.
She was better at organizing, getting things off the ground than staying with them and running them. She didn't excel at that at all. And there were there's a lot of infighting and arguing and so forth. But she had the ideas and she got things started and then moved on to something else.
May I add that in Judith's wonderful book, Barbara, she described Betty as a person with a first-rate intellect, but a second-rate temperament. And that explains why she could get these things off the ground and then didn't really, once they got into the next phase, didn't really have what it took, the skills that it took for leadership. She got too angry at people who disagreed with her. She wasn't good at compromise.
It seems that there was a real schism with lesbians in the movement.
Yes.
Can one of you address that issue? Of where lesbians fit into the women's movement and Betty Friedan's problem with that.
Yes.
Judith.
But Betty felt very strongly that lesbians would hurt the movement. The movement was, at that point, was still very rocky. And there were a lot of conservative women out there throughout America who just didn't want or didn't like lesbians and would not join the movement or stay with it if it became, quote, contaminated with lesbians. That was Betty's big fear. You know, she wanted to save and continue with the movement and make it more and more important and more powerful.
Gloria Steinem being much more open to...
Yes, Gloria
to an all inclusive movement.
Yes, Gloria just didn't think that way. She had other approaches. You know, Gloria felt that everybody should be included. So they politically they differed quite sharply.
Barbara Seaman, did her views change as she got older?
Oh yes, she regretted having used the phrase "the lavender menace" for the lesbians, and she used to also at points would say they're going to say we're all a bunch of dykes. She was pretty scared that it was going to kill her movement because there was so much anti-gay feeling that more conservative, pro-equal rights for women people would be scared off. I don't think she personally had any dislike of gay people. To the contrary, but she had her own views of how the it had to be a very respectable movement. Wasn't that really?
Oh, I think that was definitely true. It wasn't that she was biased herself personally.
Marlene Sanders, you're going to speak today?
Yes.
At the funeral for Betty Friedan, which will take place at Riverside Funeral Home up at 76 in Amsterdam in New York. What is the main point that you're going to make?
Well, I talked a lot about her impact and how she affected those of us in the media. And, you know, we organized at all the networks and at the newspapers and so forth to confront our managements, and she was very important to, you know, give us moral support. This was nerve-wracking business in the 70s. But I also talk about her as a person, how she loved her family, her grandchildren, and how in later years she talked less about feminism, which was sort of off on its own and pretty well integrated into the country, more family concerned. And I also talk about her as a companion. She was, as Barbara, you know, anybody that was a friend of hers could attest, great fun. She loved to go shopping. She loved socializing. She was a big party giver and was out all the time. She liked men. I know people think she was a man-hater, but that was far from the truth. She didn't want men in power to go roughshod over us, but personally, she liked men. And I tried to personalize my relationship with her, as well as talk about the media issues.
When do you think she went from being the challenger of the establishment to being a part of the establishment, being accepted?
When she went to visit the Pope, when the Pope invited her to...
when she went to visit the Pope.
Yes, that was a turning point in her life.
When was that? What approximately when?
I think it was in the late 70s. And
I think it was a little bit earlier.
Middle 70s.
Like 74.
Yeah, she would know. She has all the dates. But but I had the... we lived near each other on the Upper West Side, and I had the honor of going with her to look for her dress to wear to the Pope. And, I mean, Marlene talks about how much fun she could be. It was really, I mean, you had adventures with Betty that you surely would not have had with anybody else in your life. So
we have 10 seconds.
Okay, she wanted to have a dress. She knew that she had to cover her arms, so she picked out a dark dress that covered her arms but that showed a little bit of her bosom.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Judith Hennessy, author of Betty Friedan, Her Life, Barbara Seaman, well-known women's health advocate, and Marlene Sanders. And that does it for today's broadcast. The funeral for Betty Friedan will take place at the Riverside Funeral Home, which is in New York City. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fodo Kudus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Uber Rich, and Maddie Harper. Aaron Mate. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. A very special happy birthday to Jenny Filippazzo and Anna Nagara. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.